This is Nachyomi, Sefer Melachim Aleph, chapter 12. The nation of Israel gathers in Shechem for the official coronation of Rechavam, Shlomo's son and successor. Yerovam, no longer needing to fear Shlomo, is returned to Israel from Egypt to represent the population and bring their grievances before the new king. Specifically, they request an alleviation of the severe tax burden that had been placed upon them by Shlomo, and which, now that the major public works projects had been completed, was no longer necessary. Rechavam requests 3 days to consider the matter and consult with his advisors. The elder statesmen who had formerly advised Shlomo recommend that Rechavam acquiesce to the petition of the people. If he treats his subjects in a kind and compassionate manner now, they reason, he will win their allegiance and loyalty and will be able to demand more of them in the future. Rechavam's young friends, however, advise him to deal harshly with the nation and to inform them that this regime will be even more exacting than the previous one. Rechavam abandons the counsel of the elders and adopts the no-nonsense policy endorsed by his childhood companions. Unsurprisingly, the high-handed and threatening tone of Rechavam is not well received, and the populace rejects his authority. A rebellion begins to take shape. When Rechavam sends his officer Adoram out to collect taxes, the people pelt him with stones and kill him. Rechavam himself escapes harm and finds refuge in Yerushalayim. Yerovam is chosen as king by all of the tribes except for Yehuda. Rechavam gathers a military force of 180,000 men comprised of members of the tribes of Yehuda and Benjamin and prepares to put down the rebellion and reunify the kingdom. However, Hashem sends a prophetic message to Rechavam, informing the new king that these developments were divinely ordained, and ordering him not to go to war against his fellow Jews. Remarkably, and to his great credit, Rechavam heeds the word of Hashem and calls off the attack. Yerovam builds up Shechem and Penuel, establishing them as the key cities in his new regime. However, he immediately becomes concerned with a serious problem that he fears will threaten his sovereignty. Yerovam realizes that the nation is accustomed to traveling to the majestic and glorious temple in Yerushalayim for the festivals. He's worried that visiting the Beit HaMikdash, which is so intimately linked to David HaMelech and his dynasty, will awaken feelings of nostalgia in the Jews and will draw them back to Rechavam and to the house of David. Therefore, Yerovam establishes 2 sanctuaries for his kingdom, one in Beit El and one in Dan. At each, he places a golden calf and declares that there is no more need to go to Jerusalem. Quoting the statement made by the Jews at the time of the original golden calf, he says, "These are your gods, O Israel, who took you up from Egypt." In addition to changing the venue of worship, Yerovam alters the calendar, moving the holiday normally celebrated in Tishrei, which was Sukkot, to the following month, Mar Cheshvan. Lastly, instead of Kohanim and Levi'im officiating at the worship of God, Yerovam selects citizens from all the tribes to perform this function. All of these changes affected a clear break between the religious practices of the kingdom of Yehuda and those of the kingdom of Israel. In other words, the kingdom of Yerovam, which became known as the kingdom of Israel because it was the majority of the Jewish people. There's a great deal to explore and to consider in this chapter. Let us begin with the coronation of Rechavam and his poor choices of behavior. It is surprising that the ceremony took place in Shechem, because that's located in the tribal territory of Yosef and not in the capital city of Yerushalayim, which would normally be linked historically and politically to the house of David. Apparently, Rechavam was already aware of the heightened tensions and resentment toward him throughout the population on account of some of the actions of his father that had been alienating. There was a particularly anti-Shlomo feeling within the families of Yosef, the historic rivals of Yehuda, of which Yerovam was a member. Holding this event in Shechem may have been a conciliatory gesture on the part of Rechavam, motivated by a desire to calm these tensions and to reunify the tribes. At the same time, Rechavam's decision to follow the advice of his younger contemporaries is puzzling. First of all, what inspired them to offer such ill-considered counsel, and what persuaded Rechavam to adopt it? As a new king, Rechavam confronted a serious dilemma. On one hand, he understood the importance of winning the support and endorsement of all of his subjects. On the other hand, he feared coming across as overly weak in the eyes of the people, inviting their disdain or being labeled a pushover. He needed to establish his authority and his power as king and not to seem wishy-washy from day one. So while he saw that agreeing to the request to lower taxes might increase his popularity in the short term, He worried that it would cause the people to question his strength as king. The elders correctly concluded that the essential consideration for Rehavam at this point should not have been the superficial appearance of strength. His primary priority should have been earning the endorsement and loyalty of his subjects. True power is found in strategic leadership, not brute force or threats. A humble and conciliatory approach might have seemed like weakness to Rehavam on the surface, but in fact it would have ultimately secured his position as monarch in the long run, which is what really counts. His friends who had grown up with him were, like him, wealthy, privileged, and not fully in touch with the mindset of the commoners. They overestimated Rehavam's ability to flex political muscle at this stage of his career, and they underestimated the potential for revolt among the citizens of Israel. Lacking clarity as to the real significance of the moment, they preferred the macho, confrontational, and heavy-handed approach that appealed to the insecure ego of Rehavam over the measured and patient response advocated by the elders. They encouraged Rehavam to behave in an authoritarian way and to put the people in their place, so to speak. And since in the short term this indeed made Rehavam feel stronger and more in control, he was swayed in the direction of their misguided advice. Of course, this decision fed the flames of resentment that were already burning in Israel against Shlomo's regime, further reinforcing the perception that the royal family was elitist, self-serving, and dismissive of ordinary people. Rebellion under these circumstances is hardly an unexpected response. Dissecting the anatomy of Yerovam's revolt is a fascinating exercise in its own right. There are many different elements to it, and really, when you look at the revolt of Yerovam, as wicked as it was, as terrible as it was, it reflects the brilliance of Yerovam, actually, and his understanding of the political, the religious, and the social factors involved here. First of all, he establishes the political focus of his kingdom in two cities that are historically associated with the patriarchs. Shechem, which plays a significant role in the books of Yehoshua, Shofatim, and going all the way back to the book of Bereshit, where it plays a significant role in the lives of Yaakov and his sons. And then Penuel, which featured prominently in the story of Gideon in the book of Shofatim, and was the first place Yaakov arrived when he returned to Israel from his sojourn with Lavan. Yerovam places his altars in locations that also have great historical significance. Bet El, which was consecrated by Yaakov Avinu as a place of worship, and Dan, where the graven image of Micha had been worshipped until the times of the prophet Shemuel for many generations, from the times of the from the early times of the judges and on. There's a sense here of going back to basics and returning to our roots. We can almost imagine that that was the slogan of Yerovam's rebellion. These geographical choices indicate a desire to turn back the clock of history to a simpler time, a time that predated any monarchy and where everybody in Israel was truly free, free of the control of a centralized government. This is not the only way in which Yerovam proclaims a populist agenda. By putting his sanctuaries at the far north and south ends of his kingdom, respectively, he sends the message that the entire land from top to bottom, not just these two spots, and certainly not just Jerusalem, is sacred and an appropriate place to worship God. In rejecting the special status of the Kohanim and Levi'im, he makes the prospect of officiating in worship open to everybody, not just to descendants of Levi or to descendants of Aharon. Again, a very populist approach to religion. There are two remarkable parallels to Torah stories in the description of Yerovam and his behavior. The first and most obvious, which is noted by many, is to the incident of the golden calf. The language used to proclaim the introduction of the calves at Dan and Bet El is word for word the language that was used at the time of the golden calf in the wilderness, and everybody notices that he says, "Ela Elohecha Yisrael, Sher Alucha Meretz Mitzrayim." These are your gods, O Israel, who took you out of Egypt. So you have the word for word quotation there. But the question is, why are these two things connected? Now, Yerovam, like Aharon HaKohen, will subsequently offer sacrifices at the altar in Bet El before one of the calves, just like Aharon. Yerovam, presumes to become the kind of Kohen Gadol himself, and he names his children Nadav and Avia, which is very similar to Aharon's sons Nadav and Avihu. Now, ironically, the sons of Aharon, Nadav and Avihu, died when they brought an unauthorized offering into the sanctuary. Maybe, in a way, Yerovam means to negate that story by showing that he can bring a quote-unquote unauthorized sacrifice to God and will be able to survive and thrive. So therefore he named his children the same as Aharon's deceased children. But the parallel goes even further than this. Aharon HaKohen was motivated to fashion the golden calf. Why? And this is what those who point out the parallel don't really get to. What is it that makes them similar? Why did Aharon fashion the golden calf? Because he feared that the people, panicking over the absence of Moshe, would rebel against him and possibly even kill him. According to the Midrash, they did kill Miriam, son Hur. Ultimately, the people believed that without Moshe present, Hashem's providence had departed from them. Aharon compromised and created the golden calf to reassure the nation that God was still with them, and in order to keep the nation under control, as it were. Now here, too, what is Yerovam's concern? He has a genuine crisis. The people have good reason to believe that Hashem is with the kingdom of Yehuda and not with his kingdom, and that the divine presence dwells in Jerusalem, as symbolized by the magnificent temple. Yerovam feared that the people, seeing that the real relationship with God is mediated through the Beit HaMikdash and the kingdom of Yehuda, will be persuaded to return there and be a part of it. Yerovam's golden calves were designed, just like Aharon's, to reassure his subjects that Hashem was indeed with them. In fact, rather than being limited only to the temple precincts, like in the kingdom of Yehuda, God's presence permeated the entire kingdom of Israel from north to south and could be found anywhere in between the two sanctuaries that were established at the borders, the northern and southern borders of the kingdom. In essence, Yerovam's two golden calves were like his answer to the two golden kiruvim in the Holy of Holies in Jerusalem. In fact, they were even an improvement, so to speak, on them. Why? Because the divine presence was conceived as residing between the Kiruvim and the Holy Temple, the place fashioned to serve as the metaphoric, symbolic footstool of the Shekhinah, of the divine presence, and from which Hashem communicated with Moshe. As the Torah says, from between the Kiruvim, from between these two golden cherubs was where the voice of Hashem went to Moshe. So in Israel, in the kingdom of Israel, the divine presence was not nearly as limited. It also rested in between the two golden statues, but in this case, the golden calves are in Dan and Bet El, including the entire country, meaning if the divine presence rests within the northern and the southern spots, then it's really permeating the entire kingdom, not just the space between the two Kiruvim. It's important to mention that the golden calves of Yerovam, like the one made by Aharon, were not intended to be actual objects of worship or idols. They were, like the various golden objects in the Beit HaMikdash, meant to represent Hashem's presence in a concrete way. We can see from his conduct and statements throughout the next couple of chapters that despite all of his mistakes and his wickedness, Yerovam never wavered in his belief in God. He never converted to actual idolatry or adopted any religious practices or imagery from pagan cults. He merely used a so-called Jewish symbol of the divine presence, drawn from the Torah's story of the golden calf, to reassure his subjects that despite the distance of the Ark of the Covenant and the temple, Hashem was still with them. The similarities between Yerovam and Korach are also intriguing and remarkable, and I haven't seen anybody comment on them in any of the material that I've seen. But it's very obvious. Both abolished or attempted to abolish the class distinctions between Kohanim, Levi'im, and Yisraelim, to eliminate the concept of Kohanim as an elite class, and Levi'im as well, and to allow anybody who wanted to participate in the worship of God to have equal access. Both wanted to officiate as Kohanim Gedolim. Moreover, Yerovam uses a phrase borrowed straight from the rebellion of Korach when he says, Rav Lachem. He says to them, Rav Lachem me'alot Yerushalayim. It's enough, you've had enough going up to Jerusalem, meaning you don't need to do that anymore. And just as Korach said, Rav Lachem, you've taken too much for yourselves, when he confronted Moshe and Aharon. So what's the connection then between Korach and Yerovam? Just like Korach before him, Yerovam uses a populist approach to facilitate his own rise to power by demonstrating that he wants to offer the Kohanic privileges to everyone and to allow places of worship to be constructed anywhere. He continues the crusade against the kingdom of Shlomo, a kingdom that had been branded as politically and religiously elitist, remember. So the view that divine service could only be conducted in Jerusalem and only by a select group of Kohanim was, according to Yerovam, as fraudulent and corrupt as the assertion that only a descendant of David could sit on the throne of Israel. As with all popular revolts, any and all kinds of class distinction or privilege becomes anathema and is seen as part of the oppression sponsored by the state. Yerovam, both politically and religiously, portrays himself as Korach did, as the great liberator who frees the common man from the hegemony of the self-appointed elite ruling class. Another context where the phrase Rav Lachem is used is in the Torah when Hashem tells the Jewish people to take leave of Mount Sinai and begin their journey to the Promised Land. There the language is Rav Lachem Sovet Harazeh, you've spent plenty of time, enough time, more than enough time, encircling this mountain, and the time has come to move forward to the next stage of your development. Based on this literary allusion, we may infer that Yerovam marketed his new kingdom under the banner of progress, as if to say, enough of this focus on a single mountain in Jerusalem. The time has come for us to move on. We have to move beyond this limiting framework and expand the boundaries of legitimate worship. In other words, he didn't merely claim that his vision of Jewish life was also valid. He claimed that it was superior to the form that preceded it. Either way, what we see from this analysis of Yerovam's rebellion was the great insight he had into the social, political, and religious factors at play here, and how he utilized them and was able to manipulate them to further his political agenda, his personal agenda, his desire to become the monarch of the entire Jewish people, really the king of all of Israel. And you can't walk away from the story without being impressed with his intelligence and how astute he was, despite the fact that we have to recognize that what he did was wrong and certainly contradicted what Hashem expected from him.